Welcome to Behind the Story, a program where we take you straight to the source. In this episode, we'll revisit a conversation with Pat Flavin, an assistant professor of political science at Baylor University. But first, we'll take a quick look at the results from the joint primary election earlier this month. On March 1st, voters from Texas headed to the polls to weigh in on presidential nominees and local races. Here in McLennan County, Republican voters showed overwhelming support for Texas Junior Senator Ted Cruz, who garnered nearly 46% of the county vote. Hillary Clinton carried the lion's share of the Democratic vote in McLennan County with nearly 67%. Locally, incumbent Parnell McNamara edged out challengers Patrick Swanton and Willie Tompkins to remain county sheriff. And both county commissioner incumbents Kelly Snell and Will Jones retained their roles in Precinct 1 and Precinct 3, respectively. However, voting errors have highlighted Snell's win. An estimated 600 ballots did not include the county commissioner's race for their precinct. After a recount, Snell held on to his primary election win, but Snell's challenger, Corey Priest, who lost by 25 votes in the recount, has filed a lawsuit in hopes of a new election. Win or lose, Priest says, the lawsuit is to fight for fair elections in the county. You can find a complete list of the March 1st joint primary results on our website at kwbu.org. And now, we'll revisit an interview with Pat Flavin, an assistant professor of political science at Baylor University. This conversation originally aired November 2nd, 2015. Thanks for talking to KWBU today, Pat. First off, can you tell me a little bit about your background and areas of interest within political science?
So, I'm interested in political behavior, so that involves why people think the way they do about politics, why they decide to be a Democrat or Republican or not to affiliate with a party at all. I'm interested in why people vote the way they do and whether they turn out to vote at all, and then whether they get involved in other forms of political participation too, things like calling up their member of Congress or participating in a protest or signing a petition. So I'm interested in various ways in which citizens get involved in their political system.
Pat, now when we're talking about local elections, like the one coming up on Tuesday, November 3rd, voter turnout isn't particularly great. So what's the source of that? I know we tend to use the phrase voter apathy a lot, but is it really that, or are there other factors at play here?
Right. So I think there's both institutional or election factors and then just personal factors. So on the election side of things, I don't think it's so much voter apathy as much as it's voter fatigue, because in the United States, as compared to most other democracies, we vote a whole lot more than just about any other country. To give you an idea of that, in the United States, we have around 520,000 elected officials, which is a lot of positions to fill, right? So in the United States, we don't just vote on Election Day in November, right? We also have a chance to vote in primaries, to vote in school board elections, to vote in city council elections, to vote in county commissioner elections. And oftentimes, those elections are not held at the same time as bigger races, so a race for the U.S. Senate, for example, or for the president. And so one election or structural or institutional reason for why turnout tends to be so low in school board elections or tax levy elections or even city council elections is that many cities hold those elections at different times than typical elections, right, than your usual, you know, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November when we usually elect our federal offices. And so that's one reason on the structural side why turnout is so low for school board races, for example, compared to, say, elections for president. And then on the personal side of things, right, there's also just, I guess, a greater allure to say, go out and vote for the president, right, the highest office in the land, versus someone who's going to serve on the local school board or serve as your mayor. And citizens report that when you ask them in public opinion surveys, you know, what they think is more important, they'll routinely rate that it's national government. When you really look at the policies that affect us on a daily basis, so for example, how much taxes you pay as a property owner, the policies that really affect you on a day-to-day basis tend to be the policies decided by school board, by city council, by county commissioners. And so citizens, I think, on a personal level, maybe should reflect a little on that and think about that who really is deciding the policies that affect them on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, we hear about what the presidential candidates are doing, what senators are doing, what representatives are doing. But in terms of what affects you on a day-to-day basis, I think really where the action's at is at the local level. So I think more could be done to emphasize that to citizens, that that's really what affects their lives.
And at that personal level, does that include just not knowing and not really being aware of elections that are going on?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely a problem in terms of a big chunk of citizens just not knowing there's an election. And I don't think that's necessarily the citizens' fault, to go back to what I said a little earlier. I think the way in which we hold elections at different times during the year, so many different chances to vote, I don't think you can necessarily blame citizens for not knowing that, oh, there's another election that I should be voting in. I think even for, to give an example, I study political science, I pay a lot of attention to politics, but these elections that are held not in, the even years of November oftentimes sneak up on me as well. So I don't think it's, whether you're really attentive and engaged and care a lot about politics or whether you don't care that much, I think it can sneak up on anyone. So I think, from a sort of when we hold our election standpoint, maybe one suggestion would be to think about holding them concurrently or at the same time as the presidential election or when we vote for members of Congress. But in the short term, if we're not going to change the election date, I think, we could put more effort into publicizing the election. And I think here in Waco, the newspaper here, Waco Tribune, does a fairly good job. The local NPR folks here do a good job in terms of just publicizing it. But again, I think it goes back to when the election's held is really the factor there that most people just, they're leading busy lives, and this, I can absolutely understand how an election could slip by because most people aren't thinking about an election in an odd numbered year. That's usually when we just don't think about, hey, there's something on the ballot to vote, but of course there is.
That really leads me to my next question, which for local elections, there are those in May and those in November. And some people have said that moving local elections to November to line up with state and national elections would help to bolster turnout. But the concern of doing that is that local elections would get washed out. Is there any merit to that concern, or can there be a happy medium between the two?
Right. I think so. Given that we have more elected officials per citizen than anywhere else, if that's going to be the way we're going to continue in the United States, which I absolutely believe is what we're going to continue to do, then I think that is always going to be a tension. That is, when you hold down ballot or smaller elections, say for mayor or school board, on the same day as the election for president, for example, there is the real risk of those being washed out. So I think there is an argument for holding them at a different time or a different year where that's what everyone's focused on. My view or my opinion on the matter would look on the other side of the ledger, and that is, in a presidential election, those that show up to vote tend to be the most representative of the citizenry or all citizens as a whole, right? So for school board elections, when they're held in May or they're held in an off cycle year, tend to be heavily dominated by folks that tend to be more educated, that tend to have higher incomes, right, which tends to be true of voter turnout overall, but it's especially true for those elections not held during when we usually hold our elections. And so, if I had to choose one or the other, I think I would side more with holding it on that same day as we hold elections for Senate or hold elections for president, just because that's the day when most of the people show up to the polls, and therefore the electorate is more representative of citizens as a whole, right? It still skews a little higher income, a little higher education, but it's not as bad as when they're held at a different time of the year or at a totally different year. So, for example, holding elections in the fall of 2015 when there's no other federal or state offices on the ballot.
A lot of grassroots organizations that have really attempted to spur voter engagement have made an effort to reach out to those communities and other populations that don't normally turn out for elections. Has there been anything you've seen that has shown an increase in turnout for these groups?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So, for example, in 2008, Obama campaign, I think, did a particularly good job engaging youth. So that was part of a coordinated official campaign. But it also happens, as you suggested, among grassroots groups who have identified. So when I said before that voters tend to be higher educated, tend to be of higher income, they also tend to be, when I forgot that's also extremely important, they tend to be older than the typical American. And so there's a lot of room for improvement in voter turnout, particularly among low income, low education, and younger voters. So both campaigns themselves, who have an incentive to do that to try to bring more supporters to their side, but then just grassroots groups who want to get more people involved, people who aren't typically regular voters. The research or the data shows that they've been, you know, not extremely successful, but they are making an impact. They are making a difference in terms of, so to use the state of Texas as an example, in terms of engaging Hispanic voters. Grassroots groups have been successful in boosting turnout and boosting engagement among those folks as well. And then one final group or organization I'll point out, whose influence has been on the decline, but has traditionally been a big booster of voter turnout among groups who don't tend to turn out, is labor unions. So labor unions tended to turn out sort of middle or low education folks, middle class folks who may have not been real likely to vote, but through their mobilization efforts got them out, got them interested, got them engaged. So as union membership in the United States has declined and continues to decline, that's one fewer sort of mobilizing groups out there. So from a equality standpoint, being concerned that what government is hearing from citizens isn't skewed too much towards higher income and higher education folks, hopefully those grassroots groups will step in to fill that void and in terms of registering groups that tend to turn out in lower numbers, mobilizing them to get out to the polls, giving them a reason to not only show up to vote in one election, but to stay engaged year after year and election after election.
Now, I'd also like to talk a little bit about some of your other interests in political behavior. When it comes to electing an official, do you find that it's 100% one party sticking to a candidate that identifies as they do? Or is there some bipartisanship at work here, too? And which group tends to have the highest voter turnout?
Right. So I guess as a way to start on that, I think it's especially important to pay attention to partisanship now, that is which party people affiliate with if they do. And the reason is that right now a person's partisanship is a better predictor of who they're going to vote for than at any other time, you know, in recent history. So if I was trying to guess who someone was going to vote for and I could only ask them one question, and I tell my students this all the time, the question I would ask them is, well, which party do you affiliate with? So for example, this may not be surprising, but it wasn't always the case in the past. In the 2012 election, 90% plus of Democrats voted for Barack Obama. 90% plus Republicans voted for Mitt Romney, which may sound commonplace, or you would expect that to be the case. But even 10, 15 years ago, those numbers weren't as high. So partisanship is absolutely the most important predictor of whether people who people vote for. Then the second thing with partisanship is that those who affiliate with a political party are more likely to turn out to vote compared to political independents. So oftentimes we view political independence as sort of super citizens in the sense that they're not tied to a party and they're instead weighing the issues back and forth and then making a decision in that way, right? And we might expect them to be the most interested and most involved. But the data show exactly the opposite. That is, those who are political independents, that is, they don't affiliate as a Democrat or Republican, tend to be the least engaged. They tend to have the lowest levels of voter turnout. So that's all just a way of saying that affiliating with a political party or considering yourself a Democrat or Republican isn't a bad thing. It doesn't mean that you don't weigh the issues or something like that. So I would say that absolutely political partisanship is the main driver of who people vote for, and a primary driver of whether they turn out to vote or not. And then in terms of mobilization, whether one party is better than the other, I would say in the last two elections, the Democratic Party has had the edge on this, particularly at the presidential level, incorporating sort of tactics from consumer research and from business that have been used for years and years in terms of targeting certain types of consumers based on what they know about them and making certain appeals to them. So if a particular voter, if Social Security is an issue that they find very important, sending them a piece of mail that references Social Security and telling them why it's important to go out and vote, for example. So the Democrats have been particularly successful in that in the last two elections. But from all indications, my expectation is that in 2016, the gap will be very narrow, if not entirely disappear, between Democrats and Republicans. The reason being is that Republican campaigns are investing in those tactics or in that technology in terms of being able to locate voters, to target them, and then ultimately get them out to the polls on election day, which is, of course, their ultimate goal in trying to get their candidate elected.
So speaking of partisanship, in these local smaller town elections where a person's partisanship might not necessarily correspond with the office or position they're running for, there still seems to be an effort to label themselves as either Republican, Democrat, what have you. Is that a means to, I mean, if the position they're running for doesn't relate to an affiliation, what's the point there?
I would call that a shortcut for voters. So if you're a Democrat and you haven't invested much time in looking up what every one of the candidates stand for, right, which can, you know, is certainly an understandable thing to happen if you're voting for dozens of, say, elected races, right? And so you're a Democrat, you walk into the polling place and you see that, well, these certain candidates have a D next to their name and other candidates have an R next to their name. That partisanship serves as a signal for, well, I generally know what Democrats stand for. I generally know what Republicans stand for. So not knowing much else about the candidates, you know, if you're a Democrat, you'll tend to side with Democrats. If you're Republican, you'll tend to side with Republicans. Now, one way to view that is, well, that encourages sort of laziness among voters to not investigate every single candidate. But on the other hand, when we're voting for sometimes dozens of candidates, having that sort of shortcut can be very helpful for voters. And some, you know, different states and even different cities do it differently. So some states will have, for example, school board will be a partisan affair, right, where you have Republican and Democratic candidates on the ballot. Other states don't do that, right? When you go to the polling place, you see names, but you don't necessarily know which candidate stands for what. So I would say having those shortcuts on the ballot is probably a net gain in the sense that it provides a little bit more information to the voter, especially for down ballot races that maybe folks haven't been paying that much attention to. But then to quickly answer your final question about the whether your partisanship should matter in a particular office. I think Texas in particular, there's a lot of offices we vote for that that I don't necessarily see how, say, a Democratic politician would handle things differently than a Republican politician. So when you're voting for county clerk, for example, possibly even sheriff, right? Some places, believe it or not, not anywhere around here that I know of, but there are places in the country where you vote for dog catcher, believe it or not. And I'm not sure if necessarily a Democratic dog catcher versus a Republican dog catcher would be I'd be able to make a differentiation there. So I think there's definitely offices that we vote for here in Texas that have partisan labels assigned to them that it's hard to tell how one's political partisanship or ideology is really going to influence how they handle their job on a day-to-day basis.
Now, looking ahead at next year's election, the number of people that have turned in to watch the debates has been pretty significant. Is that an indicator for the kind of turnout we may see come November 2016?
Well, so 2016 is different from 2012, but similar to 2008 in the sense that neither party has an incumbent running, and it's unique in that sense, and it's unique in that neither party has the vice president, right? So usually when an incumbent president has served two terms and can't run again, his vice president historically has stepped in to try to win the party's nomination. So for example, Al Gore after Bill Clinton's two terms in office. So in 2008, when Dick Cheney did not run for president, he had stated that for some time that he wasn't, that really opened the door, I think, on both sides for more interest and excitement because you had a wide open race on both sides. So 2012, you know, kind of back to normal. There's an incumbent on one side, so there's not much of any action on the Democratic side. A little more excitement on the Republican side, but then 2016, it's back wide open. Again, so I think the part of the excitement just has to do with the fact that it's perceived to be an open race or an up for grabs contest on both sides. Whether that's going to turn into an increase in voter turnout, it's possible. I think certainly in the primaries, I wouldn't be surprised to see voter turnout at or above 2008 levels. In the general election, my expectation at this point would be probably higher than 2012, but about right in line with the 2008 number, which is a little bit above 60%, meaning 60% of eligible voters actually show up to the polls and vote on election day. So it remains to be seen. There's absolutely a degree of excitement, I think, that hasn't been seen for a while, just in terms of the number of people turning into Republican debates, for example. But I'm going to reserve judgment on whether that actually translates into greater participation, particularly in states that, so Texas, for example, uses a primary where you just go and cast your ballot for who you think should be the Democratic nominee or Republican nominee. You're in, you're out. It's very quick. But several states use a caucus system. And a caucus system requires you to be at a meeting for 2 or 3 hours on a work night. And so those that are, you know, interested enough to tune in to a political debate between the candidates and find that interesting and engaging and are paying attention to the race, it remains to be seen whether they'll take the next step of action and show up to a caucus and sit there for 2 or 3 hours and discuss political issues and candidates, or in a primary state like Texas, show up to vote in these primary elections, which traditionally tend to be very low turnout.
One quick last question, Pat, and then I'll let you go. I know early on you said that part of your interest was to look at the type of person that would contact their member of Congress. So I'm wondering, what's that person look like?
So the type of person that would call their member of Congress or write their member of Congress or even show up at their member of Congress's district office, as you might expect, they tend to be have much higher levels of political interest than, say, your average citizen. But they also tend to be, based on surveys that have been done and data that's been collected, they tend to be more educated than your average citizen. They tend to be of higher income than your average citizen. They tend to be older than your average citizen, which mirrors what I said before when I talked about voter turnout. But for those types of political activities, right, beyond just voting, the sort of skew or inequality in political participation is even more skewed towards older, wealthier, more educated folks. So voting, even though there's a definite skew there, is actually the most equal in terms of who turns out to vote. And not, if we were to say, compare that to who contacts their congressperson or not, or who attends a protest or not, or who contributes to a political campaign or not. So it's definitely a smaller sliver of the population than those folks that show up to the polls. Again, for the reason that it not only requires a high level of political interest or engagement, but many of them require, you know, certain resources, right? So if you're going to contact your member of Congress, you in most cases would want to have some experience with talking with elected officials or with making a presentation. If you're going to contribute to a political campaign, you know, you would certainly need money to do so. That's the entire point of contributing to a campaign. So those extra forms of political participation beyond voting require additional resources that we know, of course, aren't equally distributed or spread out among citizens. So it's actually voting, even though there's inequalities there, that's the most equal. But of course, we talked about today maybe some possible ways to further encourage groups that don't tend to turn out, to encourage them to get to the polls, you know, for the reason that then what the voters are saying better mirrors what all citizens are thinking. And so those voters get to elect who ultimately represent us and who ultimately make the laws that affect all of us.
Thank you for talking with KWBU today, Pat.
All right. You have a good afternoon.
Pat Flavin is an assistant professor of political science at Baylor University. To hear this episode and past episodes of Behind the Story, you can visit our website at kwbu.org.